This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Community News covering Milford and its surrounding towns. Thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. This is Sara Susskind. In the next hour, we will be bringing you news from the Milford Daily News covering the week of June 9th through June 16th, 2025. If you are listening on June 17th at 8 a.m., Poets' Corner is coming up next at 9 o'clock. Our first article, Farmers Market Season is Here. Here are 11 to visit in Metro West. Fresh produce, baked goods, and handmade items will soon be once again filling Framingham Center Common on Thursday afternoons and evenings as the Framingham Farmers Market returns for another season, joining a growing lineup of markets throughout Metro West and Greater Milford. Opening day is Thursday, June 18th. The market will run from 3 to 7 p.m. Food trucks operate from noon to 7 p.m. every Thursday through October 8th. It can be found via GPS at 2 Oak Street, despite its physical location on Edgell Road. Last year, the Framingham Farmers Market hosted up to 90 vendors weekly and drew more than 31,000 visitors for the season. This year's food truck lineup includes Trolley Dogs, a West Boylston hot dog provider, Lania's Italian-American Food Truck, and Velma's Kettle Corn. Medway Community Farm joins the vendor roster for the first time, according to the market's Facebook page. Visitors can also expect an expanded selection of coffee, matcha, and juice vendors, along with 8 new bakeries. A knife sharpening service, Simply Sharp, is also new this season. The market has been operated by the City of Framingham since 2022. It was previously run by volunteers. Throughout Metro West, several other farmers markets have already opened, with more set to begin in coming weeks. Here are 10 additional farmers markets to check out in Metro West and Greater Milford. Ashland at 125 Front Street. The Ashland Farmers Market opened for its 15th season on June 6 and runs from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Saturdays through October 17th. The volunteer-run market features 80 vendors, including farms, bakeries, art studios, and handmade goods, and focuses on supporting small businesses and promoting sustainable agriculture. Franklin at 200 Main Street. Franklin's Farmers Market kicked off on June 5th on the Franklin Town Common and runs from 2 to 6 p.m. on Fridays through October. Each week includes a sensory-friendly hour from 2 to 3 p.m. The market will be closed on Friday, July 3rd. Each weekly market will have an activity or event sponsored by a different town group. This Friday's market will be held with the town's Strawberry Stroll, which is put on by the Franklin Downtown Partnership. There's also live music and dozens of vendors each week. Holliston at 24 Water Street. The Holliston Farmers Market runs from 3 to 7 p.m. on Tuesdays from June 16th until October 13th. Offerings include fresh produce, vegetables, and handmade goods. Hopkinton at 6 Hayden Rose Street. Located on the Hopkintown Common, the Farmers Market started June 7th and runs from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Sundays through October 11th. The Common will be full of baked goods, craft beverages, fresh produce, food trucks, live music, and activities for all ages. Weekly vendors are posted on the market's website. Hudson at 78 Main Street, Route 62. Located in front of Town Hall, the Hudson Farmers Market is set to open June 16th. It will be open from 3:30 to 6 p.m. on Tuesdays. Vendors offer wine, honey, produce, baked goods, and more, along with live music. Marlboro at 19 Weed Street. The Marlboro Farmers Market behind City Hall opened June 13th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. every Saturday through October 3rd. Visitors can shop goods from local businesses and support farms and artisans in the area. The market will be closed on July 4th. Millis at 142 Exchange Street, Route 115. Held at the Congregational Church of Christ, the Millis Farmers Market will open in late June or early July, with details still being finalized. It is expected to operate until September, with hours being from 2 to 6 p.m. on Tuesdays. It will offer fresh produce, craft vendors, and live music. Natick at Natick Common, 12 South Main Street, Route 27. The Natick Farmers Market is a year-round event put on by the Natick Center Cultural District. Its summer season runs from May through September, with the market held from 9 a.m. until 1 p.m. on Saturdays on the town common. The market features local goods from Metro West vendors, live music, children's activities, and opportunities to talk with select town officials. Wayland at 397 Boston Post Road, Route 20. Located at Russell's Garden Center on Route 20, Wayland's Summer Farmers Market opens each Wednesday from noon to 4 p.m., from June 24th through October 7th. The market is in the upper parking lot of the Garden Center and will feature local baked goods, artisan items, fresh produce, and more. Russell's also hosts a Winter's Farmers Market in its greenhouses. Westboro at 10 Union Street. The Westboro Farmers Market is hosted by the Rotary Club of Westboro on the town green at Bay State Commons. The market opened on June 11th and runs through October 8th, every Thursday from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. The market will feature its Power of Produce, or Pop Club, for children, adults with intellectual disabilities, and seniors ages 70 and above, according to its website. The program aims to teach participants about healthy eating and form community connections. Vendors will sell fresh produce and vegetables, live music, crafts, face painting, food trucks, and vendors selling baked goods, craft drinks, and artisan goods. Our next article, Marlboro Played a Key Role in American Revolutionary History. The night before General George Washington took command of the Continental Army on July 3, 1775, he slept at the Williams Tavern. There's a marker in downtown Marlboro to honor its spot along the Knox Trail, the route Henry Knox took from New York to Massachusetts to bring captured cannons to the Continental Army. These are just two examples of Marlboro's rich history with the American Revolution. Residents were involved in the Revolution at the very beginning. On April 19, 1775, when word of the Battle of Lexington and Concord made its way to Marlboro, local militia members jumped into action. According to History of the Town of Marlboro, Middlesex County, Massachusetts, written by Charles Hudson in 1862, more than 180 men from Marlboro, Northboro, and Southboro, mostly farmers, answered the call for help. The drums beat, the alarm is sounded, messengers are sent through the township, and in two or three short hours, over 180 men drop their implements of toil, seize their muskets, and are on the march for the scene of action. Hudson's book reads, According to the book, it was too late for the militia to travel to Lexington and Concord. Instead, the men marched to Cambridge and monitored the redcoats, acting as a deterrent for them to go forward until a larger army could be organized. Washington came to the city on the way to take command. According to a history of the city by the Marlborough Historic Commission, several militiamen served for several months and in several battles, including during the Battle of Bunker Hill. On July 2nd, Washington stopped at the Williams Tavern in Marlborough, being escorted by an honor guard of prominent citizens of this and adjoining towns, and he then proceeded through Marlborough along the Post Road, accompanied by a military delegation from the Boston battlefront to Cambridge, where he took over General Artemas Ward's command, according to the Historic Commission. That was neither the first nor the last time Washington visited Williams Tavern, which was originally built in 1656 and then, after a fire, rebuilt in 1677. Washington first visited the tavern in 1756, then located at the intersection of West Main, Route 20, and William Street, to meet with local politicians about the French and Indian War, according to Williams Tavern, Marlborough's Lost Treasure, written for the Marlborough Historical Society by Linda Rennie. Washington returned on October 23, 1789, as President of the United States. The President was met by the United States Marshal of the Massachusetts District, Jonathan Jackson, and they dined together at the tavern, according to Williams Tavern. The tavern was torn down in 1947, although its front desk remains at the Marlborough Historical Society's Peter Rice Homestead on Elm Street. According to The Revolution in Marlborough by Paul Brodeur, trustee emeritus for the Marlborough Historical Society, a marker in downtown Marlborough honors the Knox Trail. One of the intriguing stories is the role Marlborough played in the manufacture of saltpeter. It was a prime ingredient of gunpowder, and the shortage of saltpeter made the heavy guns brought from New York inoperable, according to Brodeur's article. There was a concerted effort to develop local manufacturing of saltpeter, and Henry Barnes' potash ovens were a key asset. As early as 1775, this asset was utilized by the Army. In 1775, Amasa Davis, who participated in the Tea Party and later became a quartermaster in the Army, visited Marlborough and is mentioned in the letters of Christian Barnes. In all, nearly three-quarters of Marlborough's male residents served at some point during the American Revolution. During the 8 years of this war, a total of 375 Marlborough men were in service, amounting to 25% of the population of the town, according to the Historical Commission. This is remarkable, as the scenes of action shifted more and more to the south as the war progressed. These men, of course, were not in service all at the same time, but when the war ended, at least 75% of the male population were veterans. Fortunately, however, the casualties were small. That amount, according to Hudson's book, was considered large for the size and location of Marlborough. Few, if any, towns situated as Marlborough was can boast of a more patriotic rally, he wrote. Marlborough to host parade muster on June 27th. Marlborough will honor its role during the Revolutionary War beginning at 4 p.m. on Saturday, June 27th, with Celebrate 250, which will include a parade and muster. The parade starts at 4 p.m. at Main and Bolton Street. The muster will be held at 5:30 p.m. at Ward Park and will include a historical reenactment of a skirmish between the Lexington militia and the Redcoats, as well as musket drills, fife and drum music, and cannon firing. Our next article, Candidates Accused of Fake Signatures. Several candidates for state offices in Massachusetts are facing challenges to get on the ballot. The Massachusetts Democratic Party on June 3rd accused two Republican candidates, Michael Walsh, running for Attorney General, and Anne Manning Martin, running for Lieutenant Governor, of knowingly and willingly submitting fraudulent signatures to appear on the September primary ballot. Candidates in these races must submit 10,000 certified signatures to the Secretary of the Commonwealth to get on the 2026 state election ballot in Massachusetts. Mass Dems Chair Steve Kerrigan called on Walsh and Manning Martin to withdraw from their races in a press release. For years, Donald Trump and Republican leaders have made voter fraud and election integrity central to their political message, often alleging widespread misconduct in our election. We now see what attempted fraud actually looks like by Republicans here in Massachusetts, Kerrigan said. The irony of the situation is impossible to ignore. It's not just Democrats, though. Sean Oliver, a New Bedford city councilor and another Republican candidate for lieutenant governor, also filed an objection against Martin Manning, his would-be primary opponent, over the signatures. And Jordan Corgood, a Democrat running for governor's council in the 4th District, is also facing an objection, according to Galvin's office. The objections are currently pending before the State Ballot Law Commission. Hearings will begin on Tuesday, June 16th, according to Galvin's office. What to know about the fake signatures accusations? Adam Roof, executive director of MassDems, expressed multiple problems with the signatures in his formal objection, including that numerous names were written by the same hand, certified twice, or signed by people who were not registered or not eligible to be registered. He said that after the fraudulent signatures are taken out, the candidates will no longer have the required 10,000 signatures to qualify for the ballot. In response, Walsh's campaign accused Kerrigan of acting like an attack dog for Attorney General Andrea Campbell and said the objection is an effort to avoid a competitive race for her seat. Michael Walsh stands behind the rule of law and respects the legal processes established under Massachusetts election law, Walsh's campaign wrote. More than 10,000 Massachusetts voters signed nomination papers supporting Walsh's candidacy because they want a real choice on the ballot and a serious discussion about public safety, accountability, and restoring trust in the government. Manning Martin's campaign did not immediately return a request for comment. Democrat also challenged. Ronald Iacobucci has filed an objection to the candidacy of Jordan Corgood, a Democrat from Boston running for governor's council. Both Iacobucci and Corgood are running in the Democratic primary for the 4th District. The objection did not take issue with Corgood's signatures. Rather, it says that Corgood has not lived in Massachusetts for the required amount of time, nor has he been a member of the Democratic Party long enough to qualify for the ballot. I have received Mr. Iacobucci's objection, and I am reviewing with my legal team, Corgood said. We will respond as required by Secretary of the Commonwealth's Election Division rules, and I will have a more detailed statement at that time. The hearing for this challenge will also take place on June 16th. Who is running for office in Massachusetts? In Massachusetts, candidates for statewide and federal offices must have submitted a certain amount of signatures to the Massachusetts Secretary of the Commonwealth Bill Galvin's office by 5 p.m. on June 2nd. As of June 10th, here are the contested statewide state elections and which candidates could appear on the September primary ballots. Governor, Maura Healey, Democrat, incumbent. Michael Minogue, Republican. Brian Shortsleeve, Republican. Lieutenant Governor, Kimberly Driscoll, Democrat, incumbent. Anne Manning Martin, Republican, objections pending. Sean Oliver, Republican. Attorney General, Andrea Joy Campbell, Democrat, incumbent. Michael Walsh, Republican, objection pending. Treasurer, Deborah Goldberg, Democrat, incumbent. Elizabeth Dion, Republican. Our next article, Student Loan Overhaul Coming July 1st. Some repayment options eliminated, others get revised requirements. One of the biggest federal student loan overhauls in decades will start July 1st, and borrowers should be preparing, experts said. President Donald Trump's signature tax and spending package passed in July 2025 enacted sweeping changes to the way families can borrow to pay for school. Changes include eliminating some repayment plans, introducing new ones, and adding new loan limits to others. Since there will be so many changes at once, experts are warning students to learn about them now so they can choose plans that best fit their budgets. If borrowers enrolled in certain plans don't act, the Department of Education will automatically enroll them into one of the new plans that launch on July 1st. Go to studentaid.gov and look around and see what's going on with repayment options and what's available now, said Jack Wallace, Director of Government and Lender Relations at student loan refinancing company Wirify. Wallace added borrowers may qualify now for something that won't be available later. A lot is changing, and you have to be aware of the changes and see if they affect you, said Stacy McFetris, Senior Director of Education Finance at Bright Horizons, a provider of education advisory services. The Department of Education said there will be changes to the following plans starting July 1st. Save. Saving on a valuable education. Borrowers still enrolled in the now defunct Save plan will be contacted around July 1st by their loan servicers to transition to a new payment plan within 90 days. Approximately 7.5 million out of about 50 million total borrowers were enrolled. Many are in forbearance, McFetris said. Because the standard repayment plan typically leads to higher monthly payments, borrowers are strongly encouraged to explore and apply for other income-driven plans on studentaid.gov before the expiration of the automatic deadline, she said. Note, borrowers in Save who are making monthly payments and think they will take advantage of the lower payments until the end of the 90-day period need to know if they are eligible for and want to make progress towards PSLF, Public Service Loan Forgiveness, or IDR, Income-Driven Forgiveness. Those payments will not count, McFetris said. Existing borrowers can immediately switch to IBR, Income-Based Repayment, which is also income-based and will allow payments to progress towards PSLF and IDR forgiveness. Pay. Pay as you earn. Pay enrollment will be cut off for loans disbursed on or after July 1st. Existing borrowers with loans disbursed prior to July can use and keep it, but the plan will completely end by July 1st, 2028. ICR, Income Contingent Repayment. ICR won't be available for loans disbursed on or after July 1st, and the plan will fully phase out by July 1st, 2028. IBR, Income-Based Repayment. Existing IBR plans are grandfathered and will remain active only for loans disbursed before July. The plan will be closed to new enrollees on July 1st. Parent Plus. These loans aren't ending, but parents with these loans must consolidate them into a direct consolidation loan before July 1st to remain eligible for income-driven options and programs like PSLF. After July 1st, Parent Plus borrowers who haven't consolidated permanently lose access to IDR plans and PSLF. They'll be locked into standard payment plans, which can mean higher monthly payments without any chance of forgiveness. Only two repayment plans will be available to new borrowers starting July 1st. Standard Repayment Plan. The default standard plan features fixed monthly payments and spans 10 to 30 years, depending on the loan amount and whether it's a consolidation loan, according to the Department of Education. Monthly payments can be higher than other plans, but total interest paid is usually lower and length of repayment is usually shorter, the department said. Repayment Assistance Plan, RAP. An income-driven plan with payments between 1% and 10% of your adjusted gross income, or a flat $10 per month if your income is less than $10,000 per year. Forgiveness is available for balances after 30 years of repayment. The following loans will see changes beginning July 1st. Graduate Plus. These loans will no longer be offered. If you're already borrowing under these loans, you can continue to borrow under legacy or uncapped limits for up to 3 additional academic years or until graduation or the program ends, whichever comes first. Grandfathered loans must have had at least one disbursement before July 1st. Conceivably, a student can apply, be approved, and have money deposited into an account before July 1st and be eligible for the extension, experts said. Graduate Loans. New direct unsubsidized loans, or those where the borrower is always responsible for paying the interest for graduate students, are capped annually at $20,500, $100,000 aggregate, for standard graduate programs, and $50,000, $200,000 total, for qualifying professional programs like for medical, dental, and law degrees. Parent Plus. Loans will be capped at $20,000 per year per student with a $65,000 lifetime limit per dependent unless you already have one. Then, you may continue to borrow under the old limits for 3 school years or until graduation, whichever comes first. Like Grad Plus loans, a parent may apply and get a first tranche disbursed to the school before July 1st to be grandfathered. Our next article. These Framingham projects will get a piece of the $3.53 million in CPA funding. The Framingham Community Preservation Committee, CPC, has announced the local projects that will receive a total of $3.53 million in funding through the Community Preservation Act, CPA. Fiscal 2026 funding includes construction of 4 accessible affordable housing units at Carlson Crossing East, preservation of open space at Eastley Farm and 4345 Nixon Road, design of public access improvements at Simpson Park, design of improvements to the Walsh Dunning Softball Field Complex, construction of the middle section of the Carol Getchell Nature Trail, purchase and installation of an ADA-accessible water fountain and bottle filler at Anna Murphy Park, engineering and design work for improvements at Washakum Beach, historic preservation of the First Parish and Framingham Meeting House, design of ADA-accessible entrances at Cushing Memorial Chapel, a rental subsidy program administered by the Jewish Family Service, JFS, of Metro West, historic preservation work at Edgel Grove Cemetery Tomb House, purchase of fire-resistant storage cabinets for the old academy building. Since 2020, CPA funding has supported projects totaling more than $9.9 million in local investments and have also leveraged more than $1.6 million in matching funds from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. For more information about the Community Preservation Act and the Community Preservation Committee, visit the city's website at framinghamma.gov. Our next article, Con served Framingham for half a century. Every Sunday, for the better part of a year, John M. Con would make the trek from his Framingham home to that of his daughter Susan in Brookline. And then he would get to work. He cut and recut, measured and remeasured, until he created an amazing set of bookshelves, Susan Con said. We designed it together, but he built it. That year-long bookshelf project is just one of the many examples of John Kahn's relentless attention to detail. Whether at his day job as a high-powered litigator, in the evenings performing his numerous roles as a public servant in Framingham, or simply coming up with his next contraption as an accomplished weekend woodworker, Kahn gave it his all. He had amazing skills and intellect, said Framingham resident Mike Rossi, who served with Con on the Framingham Board of Selectmen and the Keefe Tech School Committee. I thought it was amazing that somebody with his experience and accomplishments would dedicate so much time to public service. That was an incentive for me to also serve. Con, a New Jersey native who landed in Framingham after his discharge from the Navy in 1957, died May 30th. He was 95. A half century of Framingham public service. Con's public service in Framingham stretches across about half a century, according to Susan Con and her sister, Meredith M.J. Con of Tewksbury. He served as town council 1968 to 1971, town moderator 1974 to 1977, and 2 terms on the Board of Selectmen 1997 to 2003, including a stint as chair in 2000. And 3 terms on the Keefe Tech School Committee from 2005 to 2014. City Council Chair George King can recall the Board of Selectmen voting 4-1 to hire King as town manager in 1999. He was the one, King said of Con. But I can say he was extremely supportive from day one. Always helpful and respectful. An ardent supporter of Framingham remaining a town, in April 2017, residents approved a charter change to make the municipality a city. Con also chaired the Zoning Board of Appeals and was also appointed to several municipal search committees. He was principled, consistent, and articulate, King said. There wasn't too much mystery about where he stood. We didn't always disagree, but he served for a long time, and that's commendable. Outside of town affairs, Kahn served in many leadership roles at Temple Beth Shalom, including as president and chair of the Rabbi Search Committee. All that, and yet, he was an awesome dad, M.J. Kahn said. Even though he was really busy with town affairs, he had a lot of hobbies, and he always made time for us. Young ambition develops into high-powered legal career. Kahn showed ambition from a young age. His daughter said that at age 9, their father published about 15 editions of a neighborhood newspaper called the Mattawan, New Jersey, Trumpet. And as a high school student, John participated in an American Legion-sponsored oratory contest, placing first in both his town and county, and fourth statewide. Kahn was a 1951 graduate of Rutgers University, earning his law degree 3 years later from Harvard Law School, according to his obituary. He served in the Navy during the Korean War and eventually completed Officer Candidate School and Navy Supply Corps School. Kahn and his new wife, Rona Fisher Kahn, moved to Framingham in 1957 after he landed a job with Boston-based Peabody, Kaufman & Brewer, later Hill & Barlow. Susan Kahn noted that another draw was that Kahn's parents lived in Uxbridge. As an attorney, Kahn was admitted to practice before numerous state and federal courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court and the United States Tax Court. His daughters recalled that his cases often involved representing mistreated workers. Both MJ and Susan Kahn said their father wasn't one to push public service onto his children, instead seeking to lead by example. They did recall him being proud when their late brother, Stephen Kahn, was elected to a municipal utility board in Greater Pittsburgh. Dad was never one to offer professional advice unless asked, Susan Kahn said. He wanted us to find our own way. He was supportive, but didn't push us in any particular direction. A man who was ready to speak his mind. John Kahn was never afraid to speak up when he thought things were going awry. Rossi recalled an instance in the mid-1990s when he was serving on the Board of Selectmen and was leaning toward voting to renew the contract of an executive administrator. Kahn didn't think it was a good idea. John sent me a letter, I still have it, that made clear that I needed to open my aperture, so to speak, Rossi said. We did move on and hire somebody new. As for woodworking, in addition to crafting furniture for both his and for his daughter's homes, Kahn created miniature furniture and even caskets for beloved family pets, according to his obituary. He had woodworking shops in his basement and garage, but later added onto his house to accommodate his hobby. I can still recall spending Saturdays in the shop and going to the dump with him, M.J. Kahn said. We once built a bookcase together. Well, he did. I became very good at holding things. He was a fantastic custom carpenter, added Rossi, who also served on Framingham's first city council in 2018 to 19. One time, some squirrels were coming around his home. They were really bothering him, so he built a device that was like a lazy Susan and hung it on a tree. It had room for 3 ears of corn, but when the squirrels jumped on it, the device would rotate and the squirrels would have to go upside down to eat anything. It was pretty funny. Our next article, more Massachusetts reps facing challenges this year than 2024. More Massachusetts lawmakers are facing challenges this year than last, according to data provided by the Secretary of the Commonwealth, Bill Galvin's office, although the majority still face no opponents. Candidates who wish to appear on the 2026 election ballot had to file with Galvin's office by May 26. The final list revealed how many Massachusetts state senators and representatives aren't running for re-election and how many have primary or general election challengers. This year, about 63% of incumbents running for re-election to the legislature face no opponents, down from 72% in 2024. The 160-member House, 13 representatives aren't running again, including House Minority Leader Brad Jones, Republican North Reading. There are two vacancies. This is a similar number to the 2024 election cycle when 16 were leaving the House. There are 20 House incumbents who face a primary challenger and 37 who will have a general election challenger. Some have both, up from 15 and 25 in 2024. There are 91 representatives, including House Speaker Ronald Mariano, Democrat Quincy, who have no challengers. In 2024, 103 didn't have any challengers. 63% of senators face no opponents. In the 40-member Senate, 25 incumbents do not face a challenger, including Senate President Karen Spilka, Democrat Ashland, and Minority Leader Bruce Tarr, Republican Gloucester. There are 4 incumbents who have a primary challenger and 10 who are facing general election challengers. Some have both. 2, Senator Jason Lewis, Democrat Winchester, and Senator Patricia Jalen, Democrat Somerville, are stepping down. These are similar numbers to the 2024 election cycle, when 26 senators did not face a challenger. More candidates could emerge if they get enough write-in votes in the September primary. While more lawmakers are being challenged this year than last, it's not so out of the norm. Since 2010, on average, about 118 incumbents have been uncontested each election cycle in Massachusetts, according to data from Ballotpedia. Our next article, Framingham continues bid for new elementary school. As plans for a new elementary school in Framingham continue to take shape, school leaders say a recently approved educational program will serve as a blueprint for designing a new building intended to meet student needs for years to come. The district is currently in the feasibility phase of the Massachusetts School Building Authority, MSBA, capital pipeline process, a critical stage that will determine where a new school is built, what grades it will serve, and how it will reshape elementary education throughout the city. Framingham entered the MSBA pipeline in 2023 after the city purchased a property on Bethany Road from the Sisters of St. Joseph, creating a viable south side option for a new elementary school. As part of its feasibility study, the district is looking at 4 scenarios. Keeping a school serving grades K through 5 at the existing Hemingway School site on Water Street. Building a new school serving grades pre-K to grade 5 on the Bethany Road property. Constructing a new school serving grades pre-K to 5 on Bethany Road while renovating the Hemingway School to use for early education, or creating 2 smaller pre-K to grade 5 facilities, one at the Bethany Road site and the other at a renovated Hemingway School. The MSBA has approved a design capacity for 985 students, a number based on enrollment projections, classroom size standards, and the space required for specialized services. Even as the district weighs these options, officials say the need for a new building is clear. Why a new school is needed? Although Framingham has seen a decline of more than 700 K-12 students over the past year, Assistant Superintendent for Pre-K-12 Education, Ann Lutis, told the Daily News that a new building is still needed due to the quality and size of the district's existing spaces. Many Framingham classrooms are undersized by MSBA standards, and specialized services such as occupational therapy and speech are often delivered in repurposed office space. This new school isn't meant to just replace Hemingway, Lutis said. It's meant to ease the strain on some of those schools and provide opportunities to repurpose space so that we are right-sizing the services that we're providing in all these schools. For years, the city has sought to build a new elementary school south of Route 9, where only three of Framingham's nine public elementary schools are located, a gap the Bethany Road property could help address. Educational plan sets vision for new school. The educational plan guiding the project is a document created by school officials to outline what the district wants to see in the new school building, including educational goals, space requirements, and classroom configurations. It was approved by the school committee on June 3rd. The plan outlines the district's program goals, educational needs, and instructional priorities, and will serve as a roadmap for architects as they begin shaping the school's design, Lutis said. They, the state, use this as a reference in their entire design in terms of entries and layout, exterior layout, security, how many classrooms we have, what's in the classrooms, all of that comes about because of the educational program, Lutis continued. The plan was developed through visioning sessions with educators, district leaders, and parents. Lutis said the strongest theme to emerge was a need for equitable and inclusive spaces that support students of all ages and abilities. She added that the district hopes to incorporate common areas that could remain open to families and the community after school hours while the rest of the building remains secure. Another major focus of the plan was the district's commitment to educating the whole child, which includes expanding social-emotional supports, creating collaborative work areas, and increasing opportunities for hands-on learning. Universal pre-K is a key consideration. One of the most significant considerations is the district's goal of implementing universal pre-kindergarten. A new building would create opportunities to expand pre-K access, while a renovation of the existing Hemingway site would likely require the district to place pre-K seats elsewhere. The MSBA has approved us for a kindergarten through grade 5 school, but they have also allowed us to consider pre-K, which is part of our strategic plan, where the district is able to provide every student who is in their year before kindergarten with a pre-K seat, she said. We're not there yet, but this building would really open up opportunities to do that. Next steps for the project. District officials say the earliest a new school could open is ahead of the 2030 to 2031 school year. School leaders have said the city needs to take advantage of the current MSBA opportunity, warning that missing the window could delay reconsideration. The district is preparing to submit its preliminary design program, PDP, in July, which includes existing Hemingway building conditions, design parameters, project needs, and the educational plan that will guide the next phase of the MSBA process. A preferred schematic report is expected in December. The school building committee will then determine the building's exact size and location, which will go before the city council in August 2027, followed by another vote in September 2027. Our next article, how widespread is AI usage in Massachusetts? 1 in 3 Massachusetts residents uses generative AI tools such as ChatGPT and Claude, according to Microsoft data. Generative AI can create words, music, pictures, or videos based on user prompts. For example, if you type a prompt asking for a fictional story, the AI tool will generate a passage with a setting, characters, and plot. About 33.4% of working-age residents in Massachusetts use these tools, placing the state 11th in the U.S., according to Q1 2026 data. Hampshire County, home to the Five College Consortium, has the highest AI usage rate at 45.1%. Microsoft found that counties with more employment in professional and technical services, corporate management, healthcare, information and media, and finance tend to have higher AI usage. Additionally, counties with larger shares of residents ages 18 to 24 tend to have higher levels of AI usage. Counties with larger shares of workers in manufacturing, agriculture, mining, oil and gas, and construction tend to have lower AI usage, according to Microsoft. Figures are based on anonymized Microsoft usage data and adjusted for differences in devices, operating systems, internet access, and population size. Top Massachusetts counties by generative AI usage. Here are Massachusetts' 14 counties ranked by generative AI usage in quarter one of 2026 and how they rank nationally, according to Microsoft. 1. Hampshire County, 45.1% of residents, number 28 nationally. 2. Middlesex County, 37.9% of residents, number 118 nationally. Number 3. Suffolk County, 35.6% of residents, number 191 nationally. 4. Norfolk County, 34.3% of residents, number 233 nationally. 5. Worcester County, 33.5% of residents, number 265 nationally. 6. Plymouth County, 32.9% of residents, number 283 nationally. 7. Essex County, 30.8% of residents, number 385 nationally. Bristol County, 28.2% of residents, number 553 nationally. 9. Hampton County, 27.1% of residents, number 645 nationally. 10. Barnstable County, 25.5% of residents, number 790 nationally. 11. Berkshire County, 24.7% of residents, number 878 nationally. 12. Nantucket County, 24.1% of residents, number 937 nationally. 13. Franklin County, 23.8% of residents, number 961 nationally. And 14. Dukes County, 15.4% of residents, number 2,450 nationally. Here are the New England states ranked by generative AI usage in quarter one of 2026, according to Microsoft. Connecticut, number 8, 34.0% of residents. Massachusetts, number 11, 33.4% of residents. Rhode Island, number 14, 32.5% of residents. New Hampshire, number 20, 30.2% of residents. Vermont, number 46, 23.3% of residents. And Maine, number 49, 21.4% of residents. Here are the top 10 states ranked by generative AI usage in quarter one of 2026, according to Microsoft. Number 1. Maryland, 36.3% of residents. Number 2. Utah, 35.7% of residents. 3. Texas, 35.3% of residents. 4. Virginia, 34.7% of residents. 5. New Jersey, 34.5% of residents. 6. Nevada, 34.2% of residents. 7. California, 34% of residents. 8. Connecticut, 34% of residents. 9. Georgia, 33.7% of residents. 10. Florida, 33.6% of residents. You have been listening to a reading of the Milford Daily News. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or Braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Sarah Susskind. Thank you for listening.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
Hello, Audio Journal listeners. This is Lavender, and I'm here with my two dads, Will and Jamie. We are here to wish you Happy Father's Day. So, Will, I want to know, what does Father's Day mean to you?
Well, it's kind of interesting because our situation is so different. You became our daughter much later in life, and I think the thing that's interesting about Father's Day from our perspective is that Father's Day really means that when you show up for someone, when you decide to become a chosen family and that you are there for them and that you just get a chance to be that role for someone. It's just a beautiful experience.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear. And I'm so glad that you didn't have to change my diaper.
I'm glad I didn't have to change a diaper either. What about you, Jamie?
So to me, Father's Day is really a celebration of connection with someone that you really love and care for. I like that being a father has shown me how to love unconditionally and how to have unconditional positive regard for someone. And it's about helping someone through difficulties and to enjoy good times together. And so I think Father's Day is just a representation of all that. And I'm also, I have to say, I'm also glad that I didn't have to change the diapers.
Well, Father's Day means, what it means to me is that I get to celebrate with two dads and not just one, so I feel extra lucky. So we all want to wish you a happy Father's Day to all the fathers, adoptive fathers, biological fathers, and all the fathers in between them. From all of us here at Audio Journal, part of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Thank you.